Hello and welcome to the Sporticos Football Stories podcast. My name is Craig Hansen and today I'm joined by Mark Walker, a lifelong Southampton fan and freelance journalist who works on occasion for the club and for the wonderful fan page Saints Marching. Mark has a lot of experience and knowledge of following the club and working with Southampton, and he's here today to share some of that with us. I'm delighted to welcome him to the show and I can't wait to discuss all things Southampton. Hello, Mark. How are you doing?
Yes, I'm very good, thank you. Yourself?
Not too bad. Very nice to meet you today. The first thing that we'd like to cover with our guests is a little bit about the beginning of their fandom. The podcast is very much fan-heavy, so we like to hear people's stories, and sometimes we hear ones that are more typical than others. And I just wondered how exactly you started to become a Southampton fan. Are you from the area? Was it a family thing? Could you talk us through those early days being a Southampton supporter?
Yeah, definitely. So it's a family thing through my dad, and that's basically it. Because there's a weird thing with both my granddads grew up as Portsmouth fans. I mean, that sounds really weird, I know. But basically my dad... Yeah, he got me into it. He took me down to St Mary's when I was a kid. And I believe to the Dell a couple of times as well, even though I can't remember that. We're actually closer to Portsmouth than Southampton. But yeah, obviously can't see another club that I would support, obviously.
And how did your dad end up being a Southampton fan if both your granddads are Portsmouth fans? That's a bit rebellious.
Yeah, I know. I think he went to maybe a couple of maybe it was one Portsmouth game, and I think one of the games that his dad took him to was Portsmouth versus Southampton, and I think his story is that he just naturally had a connection with the Southampton team then. Really, he just followed them from that time, really.
Okay, and you mentioned there that you think you went to the Dell a couple of times, maybe, and you remember going to St Mary's as a kid. So how young were you when you first started getting taken to games?
I think my dad mentioned that I was like four or something when the final games were being played at the Dell. I think I went to like one of the final, like I think it was a testimonial or something like that at the Dell, but that's about it. Basically my earliest memories, stuff that I can definitely remember, is at St Mary's from about 2000, 2001 to 2003, really. Quite enjoyable, but the weirdest, earliest memories that I have is, I think it was a game against Aston Villa where we were like 2-0 up and cruising at half time. And then in typical Saints style, we go and lose 3-2 in the second half. That's one of my earliest memories. And then obviously one of the best from that time is I've got very... very small snippets in my head of the 2003 Cup final. I was lucky enough to go along to that in Cardiff. So, yeah, I think one of the things that sticks out from that match is obviously the Arsenal goal, and then Saints sort of fought back really well. Our fans thought we'd scored because James Beattie stuck it in the net, but he was offside, unfortunately. But being like seven or six or something, I didn't understand offside at that time. obviously, I jumped off of my seat, uh, but it was all for nothing, unfortunately. But yeah, no, that was a great day, great memories.
And so your dad tells you you're about four going to those final games at the Dell, but you can't really remember that stuff. How old would you have been, those earliest memories you described at St. Mary's? How old would you have been more or less then?
So 6, 7, or 8, I think, maybe.
And what were your first impressions when you came into the... I suppose that would have been the second stadium you'd been to and the first one that you remember really, I guess, you know, actually knowing what was going on because you were old enough. What do you remember your first impressions, what you thought about the place?
Yeah, so from my point of view, like, I've just always been football mad, really. Like, whenever I had a chance as a kid, I'd be kicking a ball around, really, going and playing with mates and stuff. So obviously going to a stadium that, I know it's obviously not the biggest stadium there is, but when you're a kid and that's the first stadium you go to, it's obviously massive. Like just 30,000 people all shouting at once. It's quite obviously a bit intimidating at times, but it's also really cool once you grow into it and once you start understanding what it's all about. I'd say that's about it, really.
And during those formative years as a fan, sort of 6, 7, and the few years after that, how would you define that era? What kind of place was Southampton in at the time? You mentioned the cup final.
Mm.
You were in in those really early times, you were in the Premier League there still until 2005. How is there kind of a definitive way of describing that era? Do the fans think of, do they put a label on that period of time?
Yeah, I don't know if this is true for all the fans, but that 2002-03 season was a successful one, definitely, because we finished eighth and got to that cup final. And then a brief spell in Europe the season after. I would say it was, obviously the success, but the team was, it wasn't stars, like star players by any means. It was a team that was sort of cleverly put together. They had quite a fiery manager in Gordon Strachan as well.
And the goals of the great James Beattie to rely on.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Obviously wouldn't have had that success without him sort of hitting 24 or whatever it was in that season. But yeah, sort of around him, there was some really solid pros who will go down as some of them definitely will go down in sort of Saints fan folklore, really.
And so you came into supporting Southampton. They're a Premier League club. You're still quite young when they're reaching cup finals. They qualify for the UEFA Cup the next year, finishing 8th, 12th. So this is kind of a good period. But kids are very fickle. I mean, nowadays football fans are fickle in general, it seems, but especially kids. The following season in 2004-05, the club's relegated, rock bottom of the league. Was there any kind of temptation to switch to Chelsea or something like that as a young kid living on the South Coast? Or were you very steadfast in your support of Southampton at that point?
No, I would never say there was like real thoughts of switching, but just naturally I'd be going down and watching League One football with dad and stuff. My granddad on my mum's side, who's one of the Portsmouth fans, because he just enjoys any football. I know that'll be controversial on the South Coast, but I would say there's definitely no definite thoughts of a switch, but obviously naturally on football, on TV in the UK, you get the coverage of the biggest teams, and the Premier League is at the forefront of things, isn't it? So I would say that during that time, I used to love watching Steven Gerrard and Fernando Torres for Liverpool. Mm-hmm. just the star players in the Liverpool in the Premier League teams were obviously enjoyable to watch, but yeah, I'd still had that strongest connection with Saints, obviously.
But who were your heroes in the Championship and League One era during those four seasons in the Championship, two in League One, another one in the Championship on your way to back-to-back promotions? I imagine that you had heroes when you were very young during those early Premier League days. Did you have some idols in the lower leagues? Did you find, you know, were you still equally interested in the games and you found players equally interesting?
Yeah, definitely. We've mentioned James Beattie before. He was my first shirt. He was on my first shirt. So from that time, you then drop down to the Championship. The first shot I had then was, I think, Bradley Wright Phillips. As weird as it sounds. But yeah, there's a weird story with him. I don't know if you know. Saints basically were able to sign him for Man City because they won some sort of Coca-Cola competition where I think a fan won it, and then the club that they support got like $250,000. And I think he cost us $250,000 from Man City or something.
So a fan literally facilitated the
transfer. It's something like that, yeah. Yeah, it's a really weird one. Unfortunately, he was quite a good goal scorer in the Championship, but then he had some off-the-field problems and stuff. I would say I was naturally more drawn to the strikers as a sort of a kid drawing up. I didn't really... obviously you don't sort of think of the defenders at that stage, do you? But I obviously do now. There was quite a bad drop down to the League One, really. But then obviously Ricky Lambert comes along and he's absolute hero. He starts off as your typical League One target man, sort of bullying all the defenders down there, and then as he goes up the leagues, he develops into this player who has so much more to his game as well. I don't think fans from other clubs actually they probably didn't see enough of him, to be honest, but what other fans probably don't aren't able to see from his game is that, yeah, he just had an unbelievable eye for a pass. I've been doing a look back on his time at Saints recently, because I'm creating a few things behind the scenes on it. So he scored like 117 goals and I think it was 60 something goal assists. So he's literally the key man at that time, with other players obviously feeding in, like Adam Lallana and, those two are the ones that stick out from that time, because they were brilliant in League One, and then they transferred their form up the leagues as well. So it's great to see.
Yeah, I mean, even if you take out the nuance of his game and just look at the pure stats, I mean, I know it's League One, but 36 goals in the first season in League One, and then 21, 31 in the Championship, which is not easy at all, and 15 in the first Premier League season, I think. So, you know, it's really, really good stuff. You can see why he got that move to Liverpool, but I wish he hadn't, really, because I don't think that panned out so well.
No, I agree. I think, obviously, he's from Liverpool, so it was a dream move for him and stuff, but I think if he looks back on it, he could still have had a couple more years at Saints and contributed as well. So it's a shame, but I mean, you can't begrudge him, I suppose, in a way.
Yeah, he had to go for it, I suppose. And with the benefit of hindsight, we can always, you know, we can always say these things. But we were talking about some of those heroes of those days, like Lambert and Beattie. Are there any of those heroes from the early days that you think could do a job in the team now? You know, if you take prime version of one of those, which one would you most like to take? That guy in their prime, put them in the current team, and you think it would work well?
That's a great question. If you were looking at like the complete centre forward, I think it would have to be James Beattie, because he was obviously a big bloke with broad shoulders. He could batter off a few defenders if he needed to. He could win the ball in the air. And he had a turn of pace as well when he needed it, and took penalties and free kicks as well. So it would probably have to be him. But yeah, you can't. It's difficult to look past prime Lambert as well, purely because of what he did, really. Yeah, it would probably have to be Beattie.
Yeah, I think he could be a great replacement for Ings right now if you could have 27-year-old Beattie in the team.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Going back to then, just at the end of the kind of dark period of dropping down to League One, spending a couple seasons there, then Nigel Atkins comes in and there's the back-to-back promotions, putting Southampton back into the top flight. How fondly remembered is he by the fans?
He's the key man, really, from that sort of era. Obviously, you've got the players that stand out, but you know, he was just such a positive guy, really. I remember, obviously, we had a pretty good season the season before under Alan Pardew. But it was a completely different style of football. Obviously, we finished seventh in League One in that season and won the Johnson and Pate Trophy, which was obviously a great day at Wembley at that time. But yeah, as you say, when Atkins comes in, I remember I went down to his very first game in charge, and I remember there was a distinct change just within a week of him being there. Like there was positivity back at the club, but also the team was sort of linking these triangle passes together. Whereas it had been sort of your typical direct football under Pardew, it was now sort of he was trying to implement this attractive style of play, and it sort of really paid off in the end. I would just say he was just the perfect man for the job, really. Changes from day one, and he transformed those players like Lambert and Lallana into, they were mainly goal scorers in that first season in League One. And then they added so much to their game under him to sort of link with the other attacking players and stuff. It was just a really nice style of football to watch, and it obviously paid off.
What was the reaction among the fans when he was let go? Because as a neutral, I know that, I remember I wasn't very keen on it at the time, and I think it's easy when it's not your club, you know, to say that loyalty should be more important. You know, that if he gets you back-to-back promotions, it really doesn't matter what happens. Even if you finish rock bottom on 0 points, he's going nowhere. But, you know, the club made a decision, and then after that, to be honest, it did seem to kind of pay off for those few seasons after. But what was the initial reaction of the club, because I can't remember, sorry, of the fans. I can't remember exactly how you were doing, but I imagine you were kind of flirting around the relegation zone, 17th, 18th, and they were thinking, you know, mid-season, let's get someone in. Can you kind of talk us through, remind me what exactly was going on at the time when he was let go, and what was the broad reaction of the fan base?
Yeah, we had struggled up until that time, but I think he was let go in, I think it was January, maybe, but so I think just before that there'd been like an upturn in form that had taken us to it had taken us away from the relegation zone, really. So it was definitely controversial at the time, mainly because we didn't know who Mauricio Pochettino was. But yeah, I think he was sacked a couple of days maybe after drawing 2-2 at Stamford Bridge, which was obviously a big result for a promoted team. But yeah, as I say, it was definitely controversial.
How did you feel about it at the time? Taking out all of the how things went afterwards with Parch and Koeman, How did you feel in the moment when he got sacked? Did you think, were you surprised? How did you feel?
Yeah, I was definitely sad. Sad and surprised, yeah. That would sum it up. Yeah, mainly because he'd been on this journey, and he was such a positive guy, as I'd said. And he engaged with the fans really, really well. I would say, definitely there was a definite sadness there, from all the fan base, I think, as well. And yeah, definite surprise having drawn 2-2 at Stamford Bridge. Basically that.
Why do you think he wasn't able to kick on and sort of stay in the league? Because now he's kind of taken a couple of lower league jobs, and I think now he's at Charlton. And I remember at the time when you guys came up, just getting the back-to-back promotions alone, I think, was it Paul Lambert who did a similar thing? I can't remember.
Yeah, I think it was.
With Norwich, was it? I could be missing.
Norwich, yeah.
And like I said, you very much have that kind of idea that, look, this guy's untouchable. You can't possibly sack him. But not only that with Adkins with the back-to-back promotions, I remember hearing all stuff in the media about, like you said, he wanted to play expansive football, and apparently he was quite innovative as well with like fitness and recuperation and stuff, because I think he used to be a physio, didn't he? So
yeah,
he had a lot of interesting ideas. It seemed like he was quite a modern, forward-thinking coach. And there's nothing wrong with working in the Championship and in the Football League in general, but I feel a little bit sad that he didn't have more opportunities in the Prem. I mean, do you think that he could do a job for a newly promoted team that will be struggling, or do you think his days in the Premier League are over?
It's difficult to say, really. I would say he's definitely more suited to that club that has dropped down the leagues and then needs a miraculous recovery, and he'll more often than not do it in spectacular style, because I think he had huge success at Scunthorpe as well, which is where he was physio and then became manager somehow. don't know how. But
it's a very weird career trajectory.
Yeah, definitely is. He's definitely suited for sort of League One and Championship, I think, and he's more than capable of doing a job there if he uses the same techniques that he used at Saints, because obviously they paid off brilliantly. I know he obviously moved on to Reading shortly after leaving us, and they were in the Premier League as well, but they were sort of in a bad situation anyway, so it was sort of, he was on a hiding to nothing, really, I guess. But yeah, he's more difficult to say whether he's a Premier League manager. I would have liked to see him given more time at Saints, because I think he would have kept us safe from relegation, because those few games before he left, things started to sort of click into place, really, and the team was in good form. I think he's at Charlton now, isn't he? So, I think they've got a good man in charge at the moment.
Yeah, when he was definitely sacked at a strange time. It's kind of similar to Nigel Pearson at Leicester, I think. You know, how they were struggling, but then they got that miraculous comeback, and then you sack him? It's just weird. But anyway, after he was gone, I mean, it was a great era of kind of, you know, rejuvenation under him, but then he was gone. I think at the time, a lot of neutrals and probably fans were a bit shocked and maybe a little bit disappointed, but little did they know that after that you were going to have the emerging Mauricio Pochettino, then Ronald Koeman, and then Claude Puel. There's good and bad to say about all of them, especially the last two, but during those four seasons under those three coaches, we were between sixth and eighth Southampton European football. This got to be the best era, I guess, in your lifetime, because maybe you had the time when you finished eighth and got to the cup final and UEFA Cup, but this was consistently good.
Yeah. No.
Do you think that the fans were able to make the most of that time. Because sometimes fans, that they always want more, and there's always criticism, you know, that, yeah, but next year if we do this, we could go even higher. Do you think the fans were able to actually really just enjoy those 4 years? Bearing in mind that it's realistically possible that in your life you might never see a period as good as that.
No, I know. I know. No, I think you're right. I think looking back on it, we've always got to sort of see that we've been extremely lucky because obviously some fans won't, as you say, experience that sort of success in their lives, really. Yeah, especially now. I mean, we're a solid Premier League club at the moment. Okay, we might have flirted with relegation a couple of times in the last two seasons or three seasons. But yeah, looking back on the seasons that came before, we've been, this generation of fans have been hugely lucky, like you say.
And who did you prefer of the three, Pochettino, Koeman or Puel?
Yeah, so I would say Koeman, just purely because of the success that he had and the team that was built at that time. It was really satisfying to see that team come together and have the success that it did after sort of the previous team being ripped up and all sold and the manager leaving. So yeah, I would definitely say that. Obviously Pochettino was a great time to watch the club as well, because we were regularly beating the big boys, and yeah, obviously a high intensity style of play with a team that was, yeah, he basically chucked in players from the academy when they were ready. So you had Luke Shaw, Chambers, you had Lallana and Lambert running riot up front. Jose Font came to the fore. Schneiderlin became a brilliant Premier League midfielder under him. Stephen Davis, unsung hero. It was really good. Obviously the sales that came after that were problematic. Well, the fans thought that would be problematic anyway. But then obviously this under Koeman, we sort of rebuilt, and obviously, like I say, it was really satisfying to see. I would say Puel, although he got an eighth place finish in the cup final, he's viewed not as fondly by our fan base, put it that way.
Yeah, he's not very popular really anywhere he goes, even though he tends to get results, you know, I think eighth was pretty good, keeping the consistency going. But yeah, he's not popular, is he, Puel? Was it negative? What was the problem?
Yeah, like you say, I think he got the results that we needed. And we were pretty close to winning that cup final, actually. There's a dubious Gabbiadini offside that is regularly posted on social media by our fans and stuff. And I think we hit the post against United in that game as well. I think it was just literally the change from the positive attacking football of Adkins, Pochettino and Koeman to a style that was cagey, to say the least. Definitely got the results, but to be fair to him, he obviously lost a lot of those players that the previous managers had as well. So he maybe wasn't able to play that style of football if he wanted to, but still, yeah, it just wasn't. We would be grinding out 1-0 wins instead of flowing attacking football, scoring three brilliant goals. I think that was just it, really. That's just where the problem lies. Even though other fans will say, well, we've never finished eighth in the Premier League or got to a cup final, but, you know. Yeah, it was just that, really. He's obviously that was the stage where we got into the group stage of the Europa League as well. And I think the feeling is that cagey football also threw that away, because we obviously beat Inter Milan at home, which will go down in history with our club, obviously. But there was a couple of results, away results, I think, where we lost 1-0 and stuff. So I think if there'd been a style that we were able to impose on Europe instead of sort of needing to grind out results, then I think we would have made it more of an impression, really.
Yeah, it happens a lot when teams get, you know, they get into the preliminary qualifiers for the Europa or something, and sometimes they don't even make the group stage, and you're like, oh, you know, those fans would have loved you to just give everything, prioritise that. You know, like, I think Burnley had once or twice where they went out in the qualifiers against, you know, it's weird because they're good enough to get results against Chelsea, Man United, all these teams, finish seventh, and then they can't beat kind of, you know, Moldovan champions. It must be so disappointing for a fan, because you'd really want to just have that European journey. And what's the difference between finishing 16th or 8th? Who cares? Just finish 16th, but get to the quarterfinal of the Europa League.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, another point on that is that the I think our eighth place finished in the league was, I think it was something like 15 points behind the 7th place team. So we were actually probably closer to the relegation zone than we were to the top 7 or 6. So, I mean, obviously, other fans can say that we're fickle, but it was just the change overnight from one style of football to another. And, yeah, almost a little bit of a waste of the sort of pinnacle of where the club was trying to get to, I guess.
No, it's completely understandable. I mean, if you're trading sort of really nice, expansive football for really boring, pragmatic football where you win the league, then that's great. But if you're going to trade it for boring football and sort of not qualify for Europe anyway, you may as well. You'd probably rather watch entertaining football and finish 14th than 8th, I guess, right? But under Puel, you know, at least he kind of kept things ticking a little bit, given, like you said, that all of those years you were selling everyone, which we're going to come on to in more detail in a second. But after Puel left, maybe this is what the other fans would say, right? You know, that, oh, you know, you don't know what you got till it's gone, sort of thing. Because then when Pellegrino and then later Hughes come in, things really take a turn for the worse, and then we're looking at 17th and 16th place finishes. I don't know exactly how close you were to relegation, because sometimes those positions don't tell the whole story. You know, you could have been 15 points clear. You can tell me that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, how close were you to relegation under those two managers? And what was the big reason for that decline? Was it as simple as, you know, selling all the players finally came back to bite you? Or was it a case that took a gamble on a different manager and it really just didn't work out? What would you say was the main reason why you had that big drop off from being kind of challenging for Europa League to avoiding relegation?
Yeah. So yeah, if the football was cagey under Puel, it definitely got worse under Pellegrino. I remember going when we go down to St Mary's for the first games of that season, they had a sort of a video that would come up like 5 minutes ahead of the game, and it would be Pellegrino at his manager's desk, and he's sort of clicking his fingers like the Spaniards do, and sort of hinting that we would be playing this really high tempo football again. But unfortunately it didn't work out that way at all. I would say it's definitely partly their style and being maybe frightened of letting the team sort of implement itself on the league and use its talents, I would say. But obviously they will have sort of built their styles, learning from other managers and coaches as well. So it might just be their style to play that defensive style and look for the points here and there rather than the fluent wins. But I would also say that it was partly the transfers as well, because we sold that team under Pochettino and then moved to Koeman, and then eventually that all went as well. And basically, once we got into the Europa League, I think that transfer strategy changed. Whereas we were signing the Manes, like the young players from abroad who the big clubs hadn't picked up on yet, I think it was a change in strategy to then players who were closer to becoming those stars. So I don't know if you know Sofiane Boufal
Is he still at the club?
No, he left on a free transfer.
That's a shame, because he had a lot of potential. Very, very exciting to watch.
Yeah. So yeah, he's an example from that time. So we signed him ahead of the season under Puel, and I think it was 16 million or something. And yeah, there was supposedly Barcelona were looking at him before and stuff like that. So it was considered a real coup to get him. And obviously he sort of contributed in brief flashes of brilliance, like that goal against West Brom. I was there, and obviously I won't ever forget that goal, because it's one of the brilliant goals in our club's history. But those sort of moves just didn't pay off, because I think the players then, they agreed to join the club on the basis that we would still be fighting at the top of the league, and or near the top of the league, not at the top of the league, but sort of for those European places. It just didn't pay off, because they weren't, I don't know if they weren't up for the fight, but like their time at the club maybe didn't pay off like they were hoping. And obviously the managers like Pellegrino and then Hughes aren't ideal for players like Boufal anyway, because they don't let them off the leash. So it was a mishmash of things, really. In terms of how close we came to relegation, there was just a really bad results under Pellegrino, and then Hughes came in because of sort of being one of the only options out there, really. But I think he did a pretty decent job in keeping us up. Not a brilliant job, and he obviously didn't pay off the next season at all. But I think we were probably 3 points away from being relegated, really. That 1-0 win against Swansea back in that 2017-18 season was the one that kept us up, really. I think had Swansea won on the final day, I think we would have stayed up on goal difference. So it was that close. But luckily there was a huge sort of goal difference swing in our favour at that time. Thankfully, we look to be back on the right track under the current manager, I would say.
That's what I wanted to come on to, because not only the positions in the table, but if you look at the top goal scorers, you can really see how dour and negative the football became, because before you were looking at sort of 15 goals a season, top scorer every year with Lambert, Rodriguez, Pelé, Mané. And then under Puel, Pellegrino and Hughes, nine for Austin, seven for Austin, nine for Redmond. Mm. And it's not, I don't think it's that. I mean, Charlie Austin's a great striker. I think the issue is that just it wasn't a very positive team, right?
Yeah.
And now, as soon as Hasenhüttl comes in, the goals are going right back up there. Ings is banging them in. And I don't necessarily think it's because Ings is a million times better than Austin. It's just that he plays in a team now that actually likes to score goals. And I guess now you've got a more expansive manager. But you finished 11th and 15th so far in the two seasons. I mean, that is an improvement on 16th and 17th, obviously. But there's still question marks about Hasenhüttl. There's still some doubters out there in the neutral sense. I mean, among the fans, is he quite well liked, and are people quite confident about him?
Yeah, I would say there's definitely doubters among our fan base as well. I would say the majority definitely like him, and I think we can all see that he is hamstrung by having an owner who won't sort of, he basically has very little to do with the club. Like he's said to be involved in the running of the club, but he obviously won't invest any of his own money. And when you compare that to Marcus Lieber, who was there who sort of basically kicked on our rise up from League One. It's sort of a stark contrast, really, because he was ready to put his money where his mouth is, really. It really paid off, and he was really sort of influential at that time. Right now, I think, as you say, the pressing style of football, that's a definite change in the right direction, because when it works, it gets the fans on the edge of their seats or off their seats at times. And obviously he's not getting the consistent results at the moment, but it's kind of difficult, really, because he's not got the team that he would perhaps like to have. He's having to work with players who are maybe 2 or 3 years away from becoming the players that he wants them to be. Obviously, there's definitely a few players who are, obviously, the senior players who are brilliant at the moment, like Ward-Prowse or Romeu. But as I say, it's definitely a step in the right direction because of the high intensity that his style brings. But he'll have to bring about the results if he's to be considered to be a huge success. But I think he's basically steadying the ship at the moment. To be honest, I can't really see us being in any trouble this season. So, I think at the moment he's very good, and there's the potential that when he gets the team that he needs, or then develops this team into the team that he wants, that we could be close to that European or a cup win. But I mean, I think that's a long way off at this stage, but maybe that should be the true aim in the next couple of years, even if a 10th place finish would be brilliant for this season.
Yeah, I think he's done a decent job considering the resources he has, and whoever was in charge of the recruitment back in those heady days must have been a genius, because as well as the academy players that you're bringing through, you mentioned all the people that you were buying and selling, usually to Liverpool, but for huge fees, you know, and the amount of just world-class players that have gone through there during that time. And now I think that's kind of dried up a little bit. Is there a little is there a case maybe that kind of they did it one too many times? Because I know that it's difficult not to be a selling club when Liverpool come in with, you know, crazy bids and they are a bigger club. It's there's not a lot you can do, but could the people at the top have done more to have held on to some of the players? Because it feels like every one of those years when you were doing really well, you were selling like three or four absolute worldies, and then somehow the club were replacing them and somehow being just as good, but then they did it again. And I think after sort of the third time, maybe, you know, they should have been like, okay, this isn't going to last forever. Sooner or later, the next people we bring in are not going to be quite as good as the previous ones. I mean, is there any responsibility there?
I definitely think you're right, yeah. So I think we started doing that when we sold that Pochettino team and moved into Koeman. So we built that team based on players who cost cheap, who hadn't been picked up by the big boys yet. But I think where we're sort of unique when compared to the bigger clubs is that we can then take that calculated gamble on the players that could become good, whereas they need instant success, don't they? So
yeah,
it's a difficult one, really. I think we definitely tried to move away from that. Like I said, when we got into the Europa League, we tried to sign players who had been, or yeah. So an example there was Højbjerg, who came in from Bayern Munich. Obviously, he'd been at a top club, and it wasn't so much a case of developing those players, because I think they were trying to then move to players who had sort of a bit more experience under their belt and didn't need that development. But to say we've done it too many times, I think we did, but I think right now, I think we need to try and probably replicate that a bit with the manager we've got in charge, because I mean there's not a lot of money at the club due to the pandemic and the lack of investment from the owner anyway. So basically,
now would be a great time for another one of those conveyor belts of three or four worldies for Liverpool to
definitely. Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you buy them for cheap and then develop them, sell them on for a huge profit, you can then reinvest that, and it helps all stages of the club really to move forward. So I think that's definitely the best strategy for us. But as you say, there's an element of risk there, really, isn't there? Obviously, because sometimes it won't pay off.
But coming on to this season, then, you said that, you know, that things are looking bright. I think Southampton are one of those clubs that it could go either way, because I do believe the coach is exciting, dynamic, has already shown some glimpses that he can organise a great team that plays good football, and you might end up punching up and getting 10th. But there's also a lot of chat out there, you know, among the pundits and YouTubers and stuff, that they could be one of the three going down. And equally, yeah, that equally actually wouldn't surprise me, because talking of this idea of selling one too many influential players, I mean, after selling Ings, and I think even more importantly, actually, Vestergaard, I think there needs, if there's not investment in some of these key areas, I do worry, and I think that Hasenhüttl could either go on to be, you know, the next Koeman, and then after this he gets a big job, or it could be the next Marco Silva. Everyone's raving about, oh, so great, young, cool,
yeah,
so awesome, and now he's in the Championship. And I don't want it to be that, because I like Hasenhüttl, but do you think the club need to act in the next 11 days and bring in a couple more players? Do you think the squad, especially in terms of depth, is it really, really true on paper that there are three teams worse than Southampton in the league?
Yeah, I find it I find it difficult to really. I think basically your viewpoint is sort of more looking at it truly, isn't it? Because obviously I would still have my tinted glasses, yeah. But
yeah, it's hard because you're a fan.
I think I still believe that we can still surprise a few people, because that's basically what the club has done for the last 10 or so years, yeah. Because of that drop to League One, and then the two surprise promotions, and then the selling of players, building another team, and then which does really well. But there's definitely still, in the back of my mind, there's definitely still a bit of worry, especially with so obviously you say like Ings and Vestergaard, and Bertrand was a really experienced player who we've let go for free. I think there's been a fair amount of experience that's gone out of the team, and their places have now been taken by youth. So obviously Adam Armstrong isn't too young, but he hasn't been tested at Premier League level, even though his performance against Everton will suggest that he'll be a very good replacement for Ings. Obviously Vestergaard, his place has been taken by Mohamed Salisu, and he's only 22, I think. So he's obviously very young, has less than half a season of experience, Premier League experience, under his belt. And when you compare that to Vestergaard and his influence on the team last season, it's sort of big boots to fill, really. And then Bertrand is the same. So he was over 30, and we've replaced him with a 23-year-old from France, Romain Perraud. And I think we've definitely replaced with talent, that's for sure. But yeah, my only concern would be that experience, I think, because the experienced players are really your Ward-Prowse's and Romeo's, and a lot is going to lie with them, really. Obviously you've got Walcott as well, who's said to be very influential off the pitch. People like Jack Stevens, who are underrated in as well.
So what are your expectations for the season? Not so much what you'd hope for, but what you think realistically where you'll probably finish.
Yeah, so realistically, I would say probably we're looking at maybe a 14th or 13th again. And I think that wouldn't be too bad considering. But I would say that this team and this manager are capable of a top 10 if things go really well.
Are they capable of getting relegated if things go really bad?
That's a horrible question. I was looking at the league the other day, and I think there's still definitely three teams that have less talent who will be able to influence the Premier League like our players. That's probably hopeful again, but I'll say that's my realistic viewpoint as well.
Yeah, I mean, I worry about Southampton just with given these latest sales and maybe if an even bigger one happens. But I do think that Norwich are going straight back down. I think Watford are going straight back down. I don't think Brentford are. I think Brentford will be like Leeds. They'll finish 11th or something like
that. Yeah, definitely.
But I do think, you're pretty much battling it out for that last one, and someone like Brighton or Burnley or yourself could. But hopefully it won't work out like that. And before we come on to our little quiz here at the end, we do have a question from a Lewis on our Twitter page. Lewis asks, Mark, do you think we will sell JWP this window, James Ward-Prowse? So if you do sell James Ward-Prowse, I mean, that would be, I think it would be catastrophic. What do you think? Is that on the cards?
I agree with you. It would definitely be catastrophic because he's literally the heartbeat of that team at the moment, because he's obviously come through the academy. He's influential in the dressing room in terms of being that leader for the senior players, but also being an example for the young players who are being bought and coming up from the academy as well. And he's come on leaps and bounds under Hasenhüttl as well, and is one of the best Premier League midfielders around at the moment. Obviously, there's been strong links to Aston Villa, and sort of vague links to Spurs as well. But I think the fact that our club have sort of adamantly said no, that they would not be selling him, I think that's key here, because normally when they might sell someone, they leave sort of every avenue open. Like with the Ings thing, there definitely wasn't a definite no, he would not be going. Because, yeah, I think with Ward-Prowse, it would definitely be catastrophic if he went. Yeah, he's literally what is gluing the team together at this stage. So they would be foolish to sell him for any price, really. And because of that, I think they know how vital he is at this stage, and I don't think they will sell him, though.
There you go, Lewis. There's your answer. Not going anywhere. At least we have to hope so, because I think after selling Vestergaard and Ings, and yeah, they brought in Armstrong, who does look good, but as you know, with Championship strikers coming up, they either go one way or another. And I think that narrative nowadays doesn't hold up as much as it used to, that, oh, you know, even if they score 30 goals in the Championship, doesn't mean they score any in the Prem, because I think a lot of players have proven that wrong now. If you go back to kind of Austin and Ings, and now you've got Watkins, and I think every year pretty much someone comes up and bangs in 15. So I think you will be okay, but if you lost Ward-Prowse, I really think then you're looking at really serious relegation struggle. But yeah, probably not, like you said. I think the club would, they're not that crazy. Just to make whatever money they would make on him, let's say even if it was 80 million or something, the amount of money they'll lose on almost certainly getting relegated, it'd be such a crazy gamble to make. So.
Yeah, I think the key this season is having, instead of having one striker like Ings banging in 20 goals, you've got to have four or five all contributing. So Ward-Prowse is capable of maybe tops 10. Armstrong might be able to contribute 10 as well. Che Adams will contribute along the way as well. So it's about a team effort rather than sort of revolving around one player, I guess, this season. But obviously it's still going to pay off.
Yeah, well, it works for Man City.
Yeah, definitely.
They do. And I think it's probably conducive to Hasenhüttl's style. So, yeah, that, I think losing Ward-Prowse would actually be a much bigger loss than Ings.
Yeah, definitely.
But to finish off then, let's play Do You Know Your Heroes? So I'm going to ask you a few questions here. Most of them are players of the past. There's a couple of dates in there too. And let's see how we get on. Let's see how you
are. About this.
Your Southampton knowledge. Don't worry, the last guy who did it was pretty... I think he was kind of got about half of them right. Some of them are pretty tricky. Okay, so in what season did Southampton win their only major honour to date, the FA Cup?
So that was 1975-1976.
Correct. Yeah. Who is the player with the record number of appearances?
I believe that's Terry Payne.
Correct. I don't suppose you know the number.
It's 800 and something. I know that. I don't know the exact number.
That's good. Very good. 815. Very good.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I always say amazing. I couldn't do this myself for any team. Player with highest number of goals scored.
Yeah. So that's Mick Shannon. I think that's 228, is it?
Yes, correct. Very good. Yeah, nothing to worry about. I think you're going to get everyone right. The player who scored the most goals in one season. This one's going Ooh. Back in the day now.
No, that's a tough one.
One for the historians.
It's not like... It's not. Is it Ron Davis?
It is not.
It's not
Give
Ron
you one
Davis.
More guess.
Okay. Yeah, I imagine that's going back a long way, so I can't pick out a name, I'm afraid.
Don't worry, it was 1959-60, and it was Derek Reeves with 44 goals.
I definitely know the name.
But I'm impressed by knowing the other two guys that were also very far in the past. Youngest player to play a first team game for Southampton?
First in game.
So it doesn't necessarily have to be a start, but he featured in a real game.
Yeah.
This is a bit more of a contemporary
one. I definitely know the Premier League. The youngest Premier League appearance is Michael Obafemi, I think, when he was like 17. But is it still Walcott? Yeah.
It is Theo Walcott against Wolverhampton Wanderers on the 6th of August 2005. He was 16 years and 143 days. But as you said, that may not have been the Premier League, so it's a different thing. Highest transfer fee received? I thought this was apt, seen as we talk a lot about that during the podcast.
Yeah, so this is Van Dijk, isn't it? I think it was 75 million.
Correct. Correct and correct.
Yeah.
Highest transfer fee paid? This might have changed in recent days, actually. I apologize for that.
Yeah. Yeah, this is difficult because in part of my mind, I think it's Ings because I think he was 20 million.
Correct.
I've got a feeling the record just by a couple of million was Vestergaard, was it?
Well, that's the thing. I don't know if any, from what I can tell from my research, it's Danny Ings, 20 million to Liverpool. So much business between Southampton and Liverpool. It's almost like they're sister clubs.
Yeah, yeah. It's just the reported fees are a bit variable sometimes, aren't they? I don't exactly know.
How much did you pay for Armstrong?
I think it was 15.
Because I'm surprised that wasn't more, in today's market nowadays. But according to this, it's Danny Ings. And nice, easy one. In which year was the club formed?
1885.
Correct.
Yes.
1885. Long storied history. It's been a pleasure going through bits of it with yourself today, contemporary bits, the highs, the lows, and hopefully this year Southampton can have a little bit of a better season. Who have you got next?
So it's United on Sunday, which is a bit
nice,
worrying,
easy one.
But hopefully in front of our own fans, in front of a full St. Mary's for the first time in ages, they'll be able to pick up a result.
What is your hopeful score prediction?
Hopeful score prediction would be a 2-2, I think.
Nice, exciting end-to-end game. I could see that.
Yeah.
Okay, Mark, thank you so much for being here. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you about Southampton today. I really hope you get some luck against Man United. I'm sure many neutrals out there do.
We'll need it, I think.
And best of luck for the season.
Yeah, thank you very much. Cheers for having me. It's been really enjoyable.
Thanks so much for listening to the Sports Across Football Stories podcast. Please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts if that's where you're listening. It really genuinely helps a small podcast like ours to grow. Also, if you enjoyed today's episode, tell a friend. Share it far and wide. We appreciate this more than you could possibly imagine. Head to sportacos.com for news, data, statistics, live streams, you name it. Everything you need from the world of football. You can also follow us on Twitter. That's at sportacos.com. You can follow myself at Craig Sportacos. We would love to read out the thoughts and questions of our listeners, so please feel free to tweet those to me anytime or send them to us on an email to show@sportacos.com with your opinions or your questions, and we will get to them on the next episode.
Thanks again so much to Mark for coming on to speak to us today. Thank you so much for listening, and see you on the next episode of the Sporticos Football Stories podcast.